Okay, let's continue, and I'm trying to think what page, 30?
I think 33, Chair Farnum.
33, and we'll move right along.
Yes, because we've already talked about this.
Yeah, we want to try to get through this package today, so we'll move right along.
Only thing I wanted to mention, as I said earlier, right now, the way we handle litigation and appeals and other things is while we have a staff appeals coordinator, litigation is handed out to line managers. Each one kind of takes the responsibility for some piece of litigation. Indeed, it follows a pattern that we have in that I don't know that there's a single manager at PERS who has only analytic or research or other types of duties. They're all line managers, including, for example, Mr. Delaney, who you see every day. He actually runs a staff that has duties that are unrelated to his legislative duties, as well as the work he does here. And he's typical of how we run the agency. Page 34, we talked about the risk management and internal audit. We have some very high hopes for our OPIS design, because what we have put in as a business requirement inside the system is that it be able to create all the time what we call high audit trails. When transactions were done, what the transaction amounts were, whose accounts they were in, which staffer did them, which manager reviewed them, and which documents they get tied to, very little of which we can actually do today. So in terms of improving our audit capabilities, the work that we're doing on OPIS, as well as the couple of people that we're asking for this unit, really go hand in hand. Page 35, I think I can skip over that. There's no direct issues there. With respect to performance and workload measures, I mentioned the CEM, the Cost Effectiveness Measurement Survey, which we think is an outstanding survey. We also do ad hoc work. For example, in this last year, we contracted with a private sector party called Launchbox to do an 800-member review and survey. And one of the interesting things that turned up in that survey, and we'd be happy to provide you with the response, is that the people who like us the best in terms of rate their interactions with us at the highest level are people we have the most intrusive relationship with, which are people who have applied for disabilities. That, I must say, was an extraordinary, surprising finding, on at least to me. Page 37, on the performance measurement side, we showed you a graph yesterday that shows that we've had a pause in the retirement's growth rate after 2 years in which they greatly outstripped our predictions. We think we borrowed ahead, in essence, on some retirements. But again, demographics show that that the retirements are out there, as are the replacement hires that we'll have to service. With respect to page 38, I don't know that there's anything in particular I'd point out here that is striking or different with respect to performance measures. On page 39, we've talked about the deferred compensation program. We mentioned that the fact that we are able to cut fees, and I think that we're going to be able to cut them again soon because of the growth of the program. And as I said, the program is particularly popular. We have some performance measures on 40 in terms of the plan, and again, there's nothing that I would draw your attention to that's particularly pointed in relationship to the budget request that we have before you. Ratio on page 41 of administrative to program staff, I think you can see that it's been pretty stable. I think I think what you'll see over time in this agency, particularly if we get the new technology platform in place over the next 4 years, is you'll see the ratio of higher skilled individuals rise because of the more high caliber nature of the tools that we're going to have. And we've got some money in the OPIS budget to actually do training to raise the level of our staff so that they have an opportunity, in essence, to create a role for themselves under the new regime with the new tools. Administrative costs on page 42. If there are any questions there, we'll be happy to answer them. Again, I don't think that there's too much that stands out. 43, we're an odd agency in the sense that most of the money we expend is for benefits. The amount of money that we spend on ourselves is relatively small. That's not to dismiss the fact that we need to do it cost effectively, but our pie charts probably don't look like most pie charts, and the same is true of page 44. I would spend a moment on page 45 because you do pay a great deal of attention.
Butler, excuse me.
Yes, I'm sorry.
Excuse me. Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Voico, in looking at the costs of the administrative program, particularly those costs related to counseling and those kinds of things, is the counseling mandated?
I don't believe the counseling is mandated by statute. It is common practice in the United States in both private and public pension systems, but as I mentioned to you earlier, the degree of service of that nature varies from plan to plan, even within a band of kind of common practice.
Common practice, thank you, Madam Chair, common practice dictates that we have done this for many, many, many years. I guess I'm struggling as we certainly are. We've got some mandates, and the mandates, statutory mandates, would be to go ahead and take care of the existing resources and to husband and shepherd those along properly so that those resources are managed and cared for. But we have no statutory mandate that we counsel people into retirement.
Chair Clarno, Representative Butler, I believe that's true. We don't have any statutory requirement. As I say, it's traditional industry, it's industry practice, but there's a band of possibilities even within that, and there's no specific instruction from the legislature as to where we need to be in that band or where you would desire us to be. I would say, though, that in response to this question, I would say two things. One is last week we made a presentation to stakeholder groups about the way we spend their money, and we showed them how much we spend on responding to their questions and counseling them, as well as how much we spend on IT and record keeping and so on. So we do try to go directly to the people whose money we're spending and ask their views. And from what I can tell, we've had relatively zero feedback, certainly negative feedback, on the way we're shepherding their money. And these are not shy people. I think they'd be quite quick to step up to the plate. The other thing I would just like to say is that from the perspective of the members, when somebody reaches the point of retirement, our plan, and this is a statutory requirement, offers them as many as 12 different options. These are major lifetime financial decisions. And I would say that as a pension professional, the issue of how much advice we give them as to what those options are is not something that we should treat lightly.
In that regard, I'm particularly sensitive about that particular issue as a result of the fact that I've carried E&O insurance for many, many years. Are we subject to, in our risk management process, are we subject to claims for the counsel we give?
Chair Clarno, Representative Butler, that is a very vexing question because we face litigation and appeals on that very question as we speak, as do most other systems. Up to this point, the theory of estoppel has been relatively strong and adhered to in Oregon that as long as we clearly identify to the person we're giving an estimate to that this is an estimate, and that they are entitled only to what the law entitles them to, not what an estimator says they may get, we have prevailed. Mr. Delaney, do you have anything additional to offer on that?
That is correct. We do. The estoppel has protected us in this issue. We have had appeal cases based on estimates. The legislature did give the board some protection with ORS 238.55 on estimates, saying that a member would not be due benefit based on enrollment. That estimate, so that does give us some teeth to the stop.
238.455.
455.
Ms. Gates, I'm wondering, Madam Chair, if I might.
Yes, please.
I'm wondering if relative to issue number B related to PRS litigation that Chair Clarno and Representative Johnson brought up yesterday, that perhaps you would break out for us when you get that list, how much of this litigation surrounds our retirement counseling, this vexatious retirement counseling that we have. So I would like to know, and the reason I am particularly sensitive to that is because people come to tax professionals, too, and ask for retirement counseling, and you know, those folks are held accountable in courts for those kinds of counsel given. So It is available certainly in the private industry, and that's, I'm just a little bit concerned when we're providing it. And I guess in that regard, let me just go back to a, one of the surveys here, that was done, let's see, customer satisfaction survey 38, page 38, the last graph there. Do we know how that compares to other customer satisfaction surveys within the industry?
Representative Butler, we don't know that there's been a unified apples-to-apples survey done across systems, so I'm pretty certain the answer is no. The questions tend to be similar, so I would sense that I would suggest that it's probably at least apples to peaches as opposed to apples to kumquats.
Okay.
So, but I'd be happy to investigate that a little further and give you a more reasoned response than that.
Looks like over the last several years, this just covers a small period of time, really. It looks like we may be averaging pretty close to 90% overall. It'd be interesting to know if people have higher or lower expectations of other plans that don't provide the level of counseling that you've got, and if they are receiving no counseling and are satisfied with the plan, then, and we're getting a 90% ratio and they're getting a 90% ratio, maybe that's something that, again, it's a fee for service. Maybe you could charge for that.
I take your point very well, Representative Butler. The only other thing I would say is that PERS understands that there are a number of private sector financial advisors who advise people who also happen to be PERS members. We also provide the same information to those folks who call in and ask questions about the program as we provide to members. And our view is that every time a financial advisor is contracted for by a member, in a consenting relationship, and ask that advisor to call us to clarify one of the 12 options or how a program works, that in fact we are leveraging our knowledge through the private sector, so we routinely do that sort of cooperation. And in fact, there are some people who have made a specialty in the state of advising PERS members who also have other investments. I know this because I've actually gone out and give speeches to some of those groups.
Great. Thank you very much.
Okay, please continue.
I think we're on page 45. I just wanted to mention that the comparative survey. The findings, according to the third-party survey, is that, as you've heard from me many times, we have a more complex than average system because of our multiple tiers, variety of benefits, retirement options, and the hybrid nature of our system. We do provide a somewhat higher level of customer service, and we can actually, in response to your questions, Representative Butler, try to get you some more detailed information on that. I'm not sure that the higher level of customer service just revolves around individual counseling. The Oregon PERS costs are lower than our peer groups, maybe because we do a good job, maybe because we're just the right place at the right time, who knows. But at least that's what the comparative surveys tell us. And that was the chart on page 46 that I showed to you. We don't really see this chart until it's produced by the third-party vendor, so we never know how we're going to come out. They give us a survey that we have to fill out in terms of costs and services. It's extraordinarily detailed. And we throw it in, and months later it comes back, and they tell us how we fared. So we have no opportunity to influence how the survey comes out. With respect to page 47 on cost controls, we are, again, I hate to sound like a broken record, but our technology platform is what we are banking on to look for substantial numbers of opportunities to increase productivity. And a few are listed here. I mean, just to give you an example, we can't do electronic fund transfer with employers now who send in, we have to require that they actually send in a paper check. Is that not the case? I know of no financial institution of $1 billion or more, much less $42 billion, that requires that people send in checks. into a lockbox. We'd like to get beyond that. Page 48, the use of technology at PERS. I don't want to belabor this too much. I do want to point out that the RIMS and retirement software and its related transaction and record-keeping capabilities is not the only technology we have. We also have our own network inside the agency to do the agency's administrative and internal financial business. And we also have some, although it's pretty modest, telephonic capability in terms of switches and customer relationship software. But it's pretty modest there. On page 49, I'm not going to go through this because I'm kind of tired of talking about RIMS unless you ask me to continue to do so. I think I've made the point there. The same on page 50. I think, gives you a sense of the three key areas of technology that we have right now, which is the retirement system complex itself of over 1,000 programs, then our internal LAN and our telecommunication capabilities. Talked about page 51, the OPUS project, and keep in mind that we're not just trying to replace RIMS. Replacing RIMS would be a wonderful thing if this were 1988 and we had about $10 billion on hand. But it's 2001, we have $42 billion and many more programs than we had back then. We also want to replace our financial management system because it must link to the basic retirement, pension, and record-keeping and transaction capability. It's going to be a five-year program. We're working with the e-government subcommittee of Ways and Means. It is a substantial program. We've been preparing for 2 years, and we are at the doorstep of and ready, we believe, to start building it. We're currently in discussions with IRMD about their overseeing our build capabilities. And we hope to be able to start imminently if we receive legislative approval. I would say that on page 52, one of these issues that we'll be discussing with the government committee is our state of preparation. We think we've come an enormous way in the last 2 years. We have a steering committee in which the entire senior management of the agency participates directly in our technology projects. And it is the governing body, if you will. It is not a just-sit-and-listen body. I think Mr. Wyand has attended a few of the meetings and has also had an opportunity to get a personal tour of the project with me and the project manager, as well as our deputy director. So I think he has a sense of the degree of direct senior management involvement in this program goes down to the almost the programmer seat level. And we have also created what we believe is one of the first examples of an effective inside the agency project management office, which will exist only for the life of the project, but it's very important in terms of keeping the project well organized because it is big and it is expensive. We have been asked by the governor's office and others to talk about our e-government capabilities. That's on page 53. Right now, we have, I think, an excellent web page that answers a lot of questions and is a good information disseminator. However, in terms of e-commerce capabilities, it really has none to speak of, and it's largely because the infrastructure behind it is not ready to deliver e-commerce service. Page 54, I do want to spend just one moment on this because these are two bills that these are two of our bills that are before the that relate to administration that are before the legislature. And I put the two costs in here only to bring up the following issue. We have been reluctant with our board, and we'll make the same comments to the legislature, to expend lots of programming dollars to put new capabilities into our legacy system when, in fact, if things go as we hope, we'll be shutting it down in a few years. That will give us a very poor payback, but it presents problems both for our board that would like to make programmatic changes within their statutory authority, and it also is problematic for the legislature. We're prepared to do whatever the legislature tells us, but I would like to make sure that you understand that we are at a particularly awkward point in terms of implementing those things right away. Because if we have to do them right away, we have to do them twice, once in the old legacy system, which is going to be put to bed in just a few years. Affirmative action, I think we've done a decent job there. I personally man our booth at the Urban League Career Connections Fair. You know, we try to do whatever we can to encourage diversity inside the agency and still meet our business requirements. So I think that the report kind of speaks for itself, and the same thing is with page 56. I'm going to stop there and ask the chair or how would you like to proceed from this point on.
Let's see, what we have on our program is, our agenda is Sarah Gates. You want to go ahead, Sarah?
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the subcommittee. For the record, I'm Sarah Gates with the Budget and Management Division of the Department of Administrative Services, and I believe in just a second you're going to get a handout of my presentation.
Okay.
I'll just hang tight for a sec. And as you're very familiar with this format, so we'll turn right to the second page, and that will give you the numbers view of this agency's budget. It walks you from the 97-99 biennium forward through to the 2001-03 biennium governor's recommended budget. I would point out that, as Mr. Boyko said, this agency has a very, very large non-limited budget, which overwhelms the limited budget, but that is all related to benefit payments. The overall budget is a 13.8% increase from the legislatively adopted 99-2001 budget. Turning to page 3, you saw this same graph a few minutes ago in the PERS presentation, showing how limited funds are a very, very small component of the budget. In a minute, I'll break that out further so that it actually will be a little bit more meaningful. Page 4, once again, this budget is a 13.8% increase from the legislatively approved budget, and there are three major things that this budget will allow the agency to do. The first is related to the replacement of the Retirement Information Management System, which we've all referred to as RIMS. Within this budget is a portion of the funding needed to go forward with the build phase of the new system, which is referred to as OPIS. That will be taken up in Representative Hill's subcommittee, but I do have to mention it because it's in there and you're a lot of money, so we can't just ignore it completely. The second thing that this budget does is it provides staff to enhance PERS ability to respond to stakeholder and PERS board requests and in the internal audit capacity, and provide the policy and quantitative analysis that is absolutely necessary for this agency to function efficiently. And finally, there is an implementation of some minor pension system adjustments. Originally, the agency had many more policy packages that were moved much further in making adjustments, but based on the discussion of having to do this twice in the governor's recommended budget, the agency only went forward with those activities that were minor and had a minimal impact on programming. Page 5 gives you the graph that actually is somewhat useful. this shows the non-limited and limited budgets broken apart. And what you'll see in the right-hand pie shows you how the limited budget splits out. It's basically half services and supplies, half personal services with a very small amount of capital outlay in there. On the non-limited side, most of it is special payments out either to other governmental units or to individuals, and a very small portion is debt service, and that's to pay for the PERS building up in Tigard. Page 6, is the page that walks you from the 99-01 legislatively approved budget forward through to the current service level for the 2001-03 budget. The agency had only the standard salary pool adjustment in terms of emergency board actions through April of 2000. They did appear at later emergency boards, but those requests are not included as current service levels in the standard budget development process. Other current service level budget adjustments, they do total $441.9 million, and that's kind of a large amount, but most of that is an adjustment to the non-limited portion of the budget, $437.5 million of that. the base budget contains the non-limit adjustment. It does also decrease three positions due to some personnel actions. Phase-ins and phase-outs are the other large component of the current service level adjustments. This is where the OPUS system is funded, so, rather than being in an individual policy package, it's done through current service level. The agency is phasing out $6.8 million that was included in the legislatively approved budget and phasing in $9.5 million and five positions, 4.5 full-time equivalents, that is associated with the OPUS project. And this is this portion here is what will be considered in Representative Hill's committee. Finally, inflation increased the budget by $0.7 million. Page 7 starts the policy packages for this agency. The first one, Package 101, is a continuation of a request that appeared at the June 2000 Emergency Board. It asks for $225,000, other funds, and one position. And that position will coordinate the expansion of the Oregon Savings Growth Plan to local government employers. The position is reimbursed through from the third-party administrator, as was mentioned earlier. It also provides permanent financing for the reclassification of two positions. And the reclassifications were reviewed at the June Emergency Board, but because it was after April of 2000, it needs to be permanently financed in this budget. The next page, page 8, has Package 102 and 103. Package 102 makes adjustments of a little over $1 million to the PERS budget to, in effect, catch up with actual expenditures in certain areas. They cover overtime, standby duty pay, attorney general fees, professional services related to the Health Insurance Administration, and software purchases. And all but the Attorney General line item are inflated at the standard inflation amount, which was 2.5% for the governor's recommended budget for 0103. However, actual costs in those line items have far exceeded their budgeted amount. One example would be overtime. Currently, the agency has, in 9901, has a budget of $152,000, and they expect to spend $345,000. So they are asking for an additional $152,000 in the 0103 budget to, in effect, bring them up to where they're actually spending. And all the other items in there have similar stories. Package 103 relates to the Oregon Savings Growth Plan, and this is $161,701 other funds expenditure limitation to reclassify nine positions, and it does add one permanent retirement counselor to positions. Package 104 is a permanent funding request, and this has to do with additional reclassifications for four positions. And those are listed on page 9 at the top there. Package 105 relates to government relations services, and this has a cost of $172,000. It adds two positions for 1.5 full-time equivalents. One of the positions is a program technician 2, which will work as a rules coordinator. It's continuing a limited duration position that was established during the current biennium. A halftime program technician 2 position will provide support for appeals and contested cases, replacing a temporary employee, and with the time limits in terms of temporary employee duration, you can only have a person for 6 months. This will eliminate the need to retrain an individual. And finally, this reclassifies one position from a principal executive manager C to a D. And basically what's happened is that position has added a lot more duty since it was originally created and needs to be reclassified upwards. That's the end of the major sort of housekeeping policy packages. Package 106 relates to document management services, and this has a cost of $167,000 approximately and adds one position. About $95,000 of this is to replace equipment for filming and retrieval of documents, And I was told a while back that actually one of the machines caught on fire a while back. So there's plenty of need that it needs replacing. The remainder,
with a small fire.
A small fire. But still, anytime this machine catches on fire, it's not a good sign. $172,000 of this is for a limited duration support staff. And that will, once again, help eliminate the need for temporary staff. And a position of budget management is that this position should be reauthorized until the OPUS project and the reengineering is complete, at which point, hopefully, the need for the staff will disappear. Package 107 relates to desk services. And this is a demand-driven package. It's asking for a little over $85,000 other funds and one position to handle the workload due to more IRS regulations where you have to pay out all death benefits within 5 years, and the retired population is aging, and so there are more people dying, and as a result, more workload. As I said on page 10, the number of deaths have increased 11% since 1997, and that's only expected to continue. Page 11 is package 108, and this is the internal audit risk management package that you've heard referred to many times over the last day and a half. This package has a cost of $639,000 other funds that adds 5 positions. There's 2 components to this package. The first is actually related to creating a new section within the director's office that's going to be called the Policy Analysis and Development Section. And this will be a section that can perform risk analysis, policy analysis, research, respond to board requests. It's also going to consolidate the administrative rules development process, the Social Security process, and member appeals and government relations. The 4 positions out of the 5 are going to be added to this section. 5 existing positions will be brought into the section as well. Of the 4 new positions, 2 of them will be research positions, classified as Principal Contributor 1 and Principal Contributor 2. 1 position will actually manage the section. It's the Principal Executive Manager E position. And there was also a support staff. The second portion of this package is to enhance the internal audit capacity of the agency. As you heard in the agency presentation, they only currently have 1 auditor position, which is far below the standards for similarly sized pension systems. What they would like to do is add a Principal Executive Manager E with the information technology subclassification. And what this will do is allow them to hire someone who has experience in auditing information technology projects, because there is no one on staff who has that capacity at the moment. This position will also oversee the work of the existing auditor. Turning the page to page 12, policy package 113. This is the first of 3 policy packages that are related to legislative concepts that are currently being heard by the legislature. This one, 113, relates to the beneficiary change by divorce decree. It's related to and contingent on the passage of Senate Bill 357. It has a cost of a little over $53,000, other funds expenditure limitation, and adds 1 half-time position. It is a limited duration position that will address the increased workload associated with allowing retirees to change the PERS beneficiaries after a divorce decree. So if a member gets divorced, they're allowed to change who benefits from their retirement payment. Package 104 is related to pooling of local government employers. It's contingent on the passage of Senate Bill 358. It adds $118,000 of other funds expenditure limitations. This money will be used for data processing to modify existing PERS systems and also to hire temporary staff, approximately 0.5 equivalent, full-time equivalent of temporary staff to manage the changes to the system and associated financial transactions. The governor's budget does consider this a one-time need, and this package, if approved, should be phased out in the 2003-05 budget. Package 116 is the final policy package for this agency. It's on page 13, and this relates to mandatory payout. It is contingent on the passage of Senate Bill 359. The bill would change the minimum amount that is eligible for lump sum payout from $30, which is the current amount, to $200. The cost to the agency is slightly under $80,000 of expenditure limitation, other funds, to hire temporary staff to do member education and update documents and processes, and for data processing limitation to change the existing PERS system. And in addition, this package also is considered a one-time expenditure in the governor's recommended budget and should be phased out in the 03-05 biennium. There are no fee or revenue changes to this budget, and there are no technical adjustments as well. So at this point, I'd be happy to take any questions you may have on the presentation.
Sarah, on page 8, where you have the policy package 102, $152,415 for overtime pay, is that in addition to the what is in the budget summary of $278,800 for overtime payments? Is that in addition to? Same way then?
In the budget summary, which is
in the budget summary.
On the ABIS printout.
It depends where you're looking at in the ABIS printout.
It's the summary. In the summary.
If it's the summary, then that is included in it. If you're looking at, because it is a policy package that is included in the governor's recommended budget, it is included in the ABIS documents you're looking at. And if you're looking at the overall...
It isn't in addition to.
It is not in addition to. It's included in.
Thank you, Sarah.
You're
Other
welcome.
Questions? Representative Hayden.
Policy package 116. I don't understand what that means. What does the second dot down mean, Sarah?
Madam Chair, Representative Hayden, the second bullet, it says changes the minimum amount of benefit eligible for lump sum payout from $30 to $200. Currently, what happens is if you're a retiree and your benefit is going to be $30 and above, you'll get a monthly check and instead of a lump sum check of $30. This is changing it so that the minimum is $200 as your retirement benefit, so that it will lower, long-term it will eliminate some cost to the system by having to process very, very small checks. Maybe the agency can address this a little bit better.
If somebody has so little service or so little money in their account that when we annuitize their benefit it turns out to be $30 or less, right now under law we can say we don't have to give you $30 for your life with all of the record keeping expense that entails. We'll give you not $30 but the present value of that $30 stream, which is a lot bigger number, but here's a lump sum. It's similar to what companies sometimes do when they have odd lot, they buy back odd lot share amounts to try to simplify their record keeping expense. This would raise that to $200 and say if it's $199 or less, we're going to give you a lump sum rather than give you 10 or 20 or 30 or 40 years of payouts of relatively small amounts all along the way.
Further questions?
I have one.
Dallas?
Yeah. Thank you, Madam Chair. Last session, this is directed probably at both of you. Certain policy option packages that were tied into pending legislation, where, if I remember correctly, we removed them from the budget at that point and did not go forward with it, pending the resolution or the passage of the bills. Would you have a problem with that this session?
Chair Clarno, Mr. Wine, I would have a problem in one particular area, and that's I think we may have miscommunicated with them on the legislative pooling expense. What was said here is that this is contingent on passage of 358. It's actually contingent on passage of either 358, a legislative expression of the desired pooling, or the legislature allowing the board's recently passed pooling rule to stand as that's exactly what we have in mind, so just go down ahead. So it's to take it out, you know, there are two ways in which we would need this money. Either if the board's rule stands to pool, or the legislature overrides the board's rule and puts in its own expression of pooling, but the only way we wouldn't need this money is if there were no pooling at all. Right now, we've been pursuing a dual track, and we've told our substantive committees that here's what the board has in mind, and here's what it's putting into place. If you have a different idea, you know, instruct us in statute, and we'll conform to that. So if the bill doesn't pass, we may still need the money to execute pooling as instructed by our board under current statutory authority.
Madam Chair, Mr. Wayne, perhaps we could request that DAS unschedule the limitation pending legislative confirmation of the rule or new statutory authority.
Yeah, I just wanted to. It sounds like it's almost going to happen. It's going to happen regardless.
Madam Chair, I've got a number of questions about the presentation, but following up on package 114, can you just help me with the concept of pooling itself under package 114 relative to the rule that presently has been executed by the PERS?
Chair Clarno, Representative Butler, pooling is a significant initiative on the part of the PERS board and the agency. And the attempt is to address one of the two problems that local governments have had with the employees' retirement system and its expense. There are two problems. One is that some local governments find the system expensive. There's not much we can do about that because we have a statutory set of benefits that we have to insist that they fund. That's our job, the actuarial expense. The other part, though, is the way the system has grown over time is that we have two pools and then lots of individual governments. So we really have almost 800 pension plans. We have one big pension plan for all the state workers in a big pool. We have one big pool of most of the educational workers. And then we have City of Clackamas, City of Pendleton, Rogue River Irrigation District. Each of them has in what in essence is a standalone plan, even if they have only two employees. So from an actuarial point of view, we calculate it as if they were a plan of two people. Well, the law of small numbers means that if one of those two people gets disabled, their rate can go from 8% to 40%, and we talked about this yesterday. On the other hand, if there's some other positive event, it can fall from 35% to 12%. Each valuation, we have many examples of this high volatility. So the second problem, so the first problem that some local governments have is it's expensive. The second problem is for budgeting one is that we can't tell from valuation to valuation whether we're going to be at 12% or 40% or 25%. By putting offering on a voluntary basis local governments to join a big pool like the state pool. And there are many different ways this can be done. The rule that the board recently passed creates one just for local government. But there have been proposals for local government workers to join the state pool or to create one complete statewide pool with educational workers as well. But what that does is that it evens out some of these ups and downs. It doesn't make the system less expensive necessarily, but it makes rates that these local budget officials have to face far less volatile. And that's the initiative, and we think it has pretty broad support. Mr. Wyatt asked whether or not we thought that was going to go through, and we think there's very high probability that either there'll be a legislative expression or the legislature will permit the board to go ahead with its proposal.
Thank you very much. So if I understand correctly, the pooling concept would not affect necessarily the school employees nor the state employees, but only those other employees, the all other employees under that program. And the one-time need there is to go ahead and to consolidate all of those different accounts into one single type of accounting system. Is that what we're talking about?
That's correct. Some of it is IT expense. Some of it is we need to contract for some actuarial studies to make sure, because the board has to certify that a proposed voluntary pool actually is actuarially sound before we allow it to be formed and take legal form. And so we have to have some money to make sure that we have the ability to analyze that and make a reasoned decision about it.
Half-time person would then be an actuarial employee of some sort?
I wish, but I think that it'll be a financial person. It's unlikely that it'll be an actuarially certified person.
Okay. Moving backwards to package 113, change in divorce decrees. this has been around for some time. Do we know how many of these per year that we're looking at, divorce calculations?
I'm told by the staff, Chair Crono, Representative Butler, that it's about 75 per year, and I believe that they're all done manually. Is that correct?
So 75 per year, and do we anticipate some significant increase in the number of divorces? Is that why we're adding the package 113?
Madam Chair, Representative Butler, again for the record, Steve Delaney of PERS. Let me clarify on the 75. 75 is how many we expect would happen per year with the passage of the bill. We have about 200 that are able to be done. But once a member begins drawing a benefit, once they retire, begin drawing a benefit, you only have 60 days after the receipt of your first benefit to make any change to your beneficiary. So there are about 75 a year that we reject because they come in after that period of time. This bill would allow PERS to begin implementing those.
Implementing the other 75.
The other 75.
Well, that would imply that 75 is probably the minimum we would get, because if we opened the doors to this, it's a possibility that we could get more.
It's possible. The issue is that if a person were to divorce a year after having retired, that they could no longer direct where their benefits would go. They would go to the, if they had named their now ex-spouse, that is who would get it. They could not change that without the passage of this bill.
Okay. And in that regard, then, is there an additional charge for this type of service? Again, fee for service, right now there's no additional charge for...
That's correct, Representative Butler. We do have some fee for services. I was just given the thrust of your question yesterday. I was talking with Mr. Orr, our CFO, and there are instances, for example, in the Benefit Equalization Fund, where we actually do assess a charge to the accounts to set up this non-qualified add-on to protect our Internal Revenue Code qualification. But by and large, for most of these specialized transactions, we do not have a transaction fee, if you will.
I wonder if I might have a copy of the transaction fee that's being charged and the amount of revenue that we receive under those transactions that we presently charge for. Again, just examining it from a standpoint of what we're actually doing, I don't think it would be appropriate to discuss the information technology portions at this point. That will be driven largely by the e-government subcommittee. The death services, as you indicated, was being demand-driven under Package 107. And because of the aging of the employees, 11% increase, is that a position, one full-time position there that's being requested, indicates that a new IRS regulation requires that all beneficiaries be paid within 5 years of the member's death. How recent is that IRS regulation been promulgated?
Representative Butler, I'll have to ask the staff that question as to when it came into effect, the IRS rule.
Senator Clarno, Representative Butler, I believe that...
Identify yourself, please.
For the record, my name is Dale Orr. I'm the Fiscal Services Division Administrator for PERS. In answer to your question, I believe that we referred to that as the minimum required distribution requirement. And it came into effect starting January 1st, 1999, I believe.
So prior to that particular time, what would happen is that had they selected a 15-year payout and they were 2 years into a 15-year payout, they would receive, their beneficiaries would continue to receive over the remainder of the 15-year option.
Senator Clarno, Representative Butler, the way I understand the Internal Revenue requirement on that is more of a situation where an active member dies and they have not retired and have not started receiving their benefit. And under the required minimum distribution, that it requires that those benefit or that remaining benefit of the member, the deceased member, be paid out within 5 years. Prior to that, there was no restriction on the amount of time that they could keep the account balance and then at some later date retire as a beneficiary.
I think the key part there is that even a young active member who dies, we have to treat according to the new IRS ruling, not just people who expire post-retirement.
Let me just make sure I understand, though, in this process. I think we said earlier that there were 13 options of payouts. This becomes a 14th option, in effect, but optional as a result of death. And so this is basically a calculation-driven formula based upon death. That's the 14th method of payout, in effect.
I suppose that's one way to look at it, triggered by death, including pre-retirement. I think one of the problems that we have here is not just doing the calculation, but getting timely notification of death. This has been an issue for us. We combed through various databases to try to find notices of members who die, so that, one, we don't continue providing checks to retirees who unfortunately have died, but also to make sure that we stay in compliance with the IRS. And we still, we're still not satisfied with our ability to ensure that we have timely knowledge of a member's passing.
Amongst those databases, if I may please just follow up on that particular issue, amongst those databases, do we share information with the Oregon Department of Revenue as to the death of a beneficiary? They're not still filing and signing a tax return normally.
That's a good question, but I don't know the specific answer of whether or not we have a formal and regular transmittal of that information to Department of Revenue. That's something
find that out to see if they're actually cooperating.
Well, since that director is one of my board members, if there's need for communication, I can assure you it'll be there.
Madam Chair, I have a number of other questions, but this probably is not appropriate time to dive into them. So,
well, either go ahead, or we'll have them wait. Go ahead.
I just hesitate to do we have the information relative to the non-limited special payments include the PERS building in Tigard. I'm wondering if we could get the debt service information on that building. $1.4 million, and the balance on that. How has that been financed?
I think we have a share of a certificate of participation, and the net change in that this year. I just happened to be discussing this with Mr. Orr last night. Is approximately $1,000 this year. Versus the last biennium, so it's been relatively constant. I was asking why it would go up $1,000 if the building is depreciating over time, but we didn't have a good answer to that. But fortunately, the change is $1,000.
Okay, so at $1.4 million for biennium, and then you'd indicated that in addition to retirees, you also had payments to other governmental entities. What would the other payments to governmental entities be in that case, Sarah?
While the staff is thinking of the potential opportunities, I know that we do issue refund checks for over contributions by public employers that come in. And so sometimes we expend money back in order to make sure that they have paid only the right amount and not more. Are there other examples?
Money for paying the debt on the hangers. Okay, I'll leave you alone. I just got one of the questions I've written down.
Madam Chair, we'll have to get back to
okay.
Our staff.
Yeah, I would like that information. And you say that right now there's no ability to receive those dollar amounts in from third party governmental entities by electronic transfer.
That's correct.
So in every day's mail, you must have some, it must be just payday, look like payday to you.
I was asking Mr. Orr about this the other day. They get sent to a lockbox at the custodian bank for the state of Oregon, so we actually never see the checks. We only see the amounts. But
is that state custodian bank, is that in the state of Oregon?
Chair Clarno, Representative Butler, that is correct. It's U.S. Bank.
In Oregon?
Yes.
Okay. And again, with regard to those non-limited special payments, any portion of that go out on the PAM Corp building at Portland?
I think I can address that, although that's a question that can only be answered definitively by the Treasury staff who actually oversees the investment. But we have recently, on the OIC, reviewed the PAM Corp investment, and I believe that the net funds that we take from the PAM Corp rental, I believe the building is rented now, net of whatever expenses we have, is included and reported net to us in the fund's performance. So we don't see that in our own budget. Is that correct, Dale?
Right.
We don't make any payments to investment entities or facilities that are part of the investment portfolio of the fund itself.
As much as that's an asset, in effect, the asset and liability, I guess, it's an asset. Treated as an asset at that point, I assume. And we didn't get a detailed accounting from the treasurer. I think I would like to just take a quick look at the breakdown of the at least the biannual obligation receipts and disbursements. If I could see that broad, I think I would feel a little. So I know how much rent. There was a discussion of rent and management charge, and that the utilities and all those sorts of things kind of offset themselves. And then over under the 1.35 limited budget, there's a 0.01 capital outlay. That's on your page 5, Sarah.
Mm-hmm.
What's the capital outlay there?
I presume it doesn't refer to the Capitol building itself, though,
no.
Representative.
No, that would be capital A L, and this is a capital outlay, so I guess it's really A L.
Yes, Madam Chair, Representative Butler, there are three different components of that part, and capital outlays used for any expenditure over $5,000. The agency has about $34,000 for office furniture and fixtures, $153,000 for technical equipment, and there's only two things that they're buying with that money. So part of it is for, I'm assuming, computer equipment, things like that.
$153,000.
Yes, and the remainder is to purchase furniture and fixtures for the office buildings in Portland and Salem.
And that total is $187,000 then?
Rounding errors, 186,318 is the exact number.
Okay. But the technical equipment, is that just replacement of computers, $153,000, you think, then?
Chair Carno, Representative Butler, that is correct. That is replacement costs for the PCs that are on our individual employees' desk.
Might it also not be the imaging machines that we discussed later on, the ones that catch on fire occasionally?
Yes, I believe that.
That's a separate package, isn't it?
Well, that's included in the roll-up. The numbers I gave you are agency-wide, budget-wide, so those include anything that are in packages, and I will look at the package 106 and let you know exactly what is in there.
Okay.
If I may continue, $100,000, $95,000 of that amount, $186,000 is included. Reflects package 106.
Oh, so package 106 is already in?
Yes.
Okay, all right.
It's already included.
Okay.
That's what I thought.
Okay, all right. And then the question that I had related to the 1.35%, which that's inclusive of all administration, is that right? The 1.35, again, going back to page 5.
Madam Chair, Representative Butler, That is correct.
So all administration is covered there. I'm wondering if I might ask, and you folks have direct access to a lot of these markets, I wonder if I might ask for a breakdown of how that compares in today's market environment related to what other plans that for administration might be charging. Give me some feel as to whether or not we're and maybe it's in apples and oranges and bananas comparison again, because maybe they don't do the financial counseling, but again, we didn't have any obligation to do the financial counseling, as I recall. So, and then I just wanted to make sure on the any of the other technical equipment that was involved there under package 106, is that all being replaced so that that would all be compatible with whatever kind of a RIMS versus the other newer system is, or Opus system that we're considering?
Chair Clarno, Representative Butler, we're not buying anything, and I mean anything, that isn't compatible with Opus, and unless it's going to be completely have nothing to do with the in this particular case, I'd have to check these machines, because they may have a lifespan that that will make them obsolete by the time this portion of Opus would come on stream. But we are very sensitive to having equipment on board that isn't compatible with the platform that we plan for the future. Could I also, Representative Butler, respond to your question on page 5 about the 1.35%? We do have a little bit of an apples and oranges problem, because this looks at administrative expense in terms of the amount of benefit payments. Now, a young pension plan that has relatively few retirees will look very bad on that measure, because they may have a growing base of assets that they have to recoup for, but not very many payments to retirees yet. On the other hand, a very mature pension plan, say something like New York State Teachers, that's been around for 100 years, might have a huge array of payments, but relative to their current asset base, so they might look terrific. Most asset management companies in the private sector, as well as in the public sector, look at, and the thing that I think that you might find more directly comparative to your own experience,
to the total asset
is percent of assets.
Could we just get that? That's probably the more available, readily available piece of information.
That's what I'm suggesting. Yeah. We can show you what these expenses are as a percent of assets.
That would be the appropriate comparison, certainly. And then relative to package 103, that's again the Oregon Savings Program, and there we're adding 9 positions or funding reclassifications of 9 positions and adding 1 permanent retirement counselor number 2 position full time. Is that right for that?
That is correct. The bulk of the money is with the reclassifications.
Okay, and that would be. That would be consistent with a charge back to the Oregon Savings Growth Plan, so that we know exactly how much that's not feeding into any of the PERS funds.
No, again, hark back to our conversation yesterday, Representative Butler. We do everything we can to, because we're required to have these trust funds be standing on their own financial merits. We are limited to some extent because of our cost allocation system is relatively primitive. And one of the first things that will come on stream in Opus as we begin the build will be a new general ledger package that will have far more sophisticated ability to do cost allocation and be able to pinpoint exactly what Oregon Savings Growth expenses are versus PERS expenses versus retirement insurance.
I have some ministerial questions that I can handle.
Would you like to have them stay and answer that for you?
I also have a Crane School District here.
Oh, well, I've been to Crane. That's a wonderful school.
That's
I
wonderful.
Love Crane.
Then we'll start with this package tomorrow. Is that correct? This package, if you want to glance for your nighttime reading.
Thank you.
Bedtime reading. And with that, Dallas, do you have anything? We'll see you tomorrow. Thanks very
Thank
much.
You.
We are adjourned.
I'm wondering who was reading. Yeah, they could be, and I know you got the actual that was wrong.
Yes.